It's time for another episode of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes. Here's your host, Terrence McCauley.
Gavin Stone has served as a security and intelligence covert operative with over 20 years of experience with the British Ministry of Defense. The Unforgiven Spy is his latest novel and is available everywhere. Gavin, thanks for being here.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So why don't you tell us a little bit about The Unforgiven Spy?
Sure. So when I first got into the whole writing concept of putting something together, at first it was meant to be an autobiographical style book. And when I first wrote it, it was... There was a lot of things that I revealed that I thought, this is going to start World War III if I try and release this. So I thought, I can't put this out into the public. There's just too much that would have created a lot of problems for a lot of people. So I watered it down a little bit to try and change it so it wasn't quite so revealing. And unfortunately, when I watered it down, it was that diluted that even I didn't want to read it. It was dreadful. So I got onto a friend of mine from MI6, and you know, he's an accomplished author himself, and he said, look, write it as fiction. You know, write something that you can draw on different experiences from your life and put it out there as fiction. And I thought, okay, that's a better way of doing this. So I put this book together originally I created the characters' names and that kind of thing, and I created a storyline that I hadn't done. So in this book, the main character's daughter and wife gets kidnapped. Now, that's never happened to me. Luckily, I've asked for a few inquiries, but nobody wanted to take the job, unfortunately. I'm still looking, but no. In all seriousness, the wife maybe, not the kid. But in all seriousness, that never happened to me. But everything else in the entire book is based on the actual first-hand experience. So, you know, and not all of it is like the order it happened. It's not sequential. I've just grabbed a little bit of something that happened here and a little bit of something that happened there at different points in my life, and I've put it through this book. And it was actually originally it was going to be a comedy. It was originally called Spy at Home Dad, and it was about a guy who leaves the intelligence career to kind of, you know, look after, be a full-time stay-at-home dad, and all the comedy and the dealing with all the new things that he hasn't had to do before. And unfortunately, because of the world I've worked in for so many years, it took a very dark turn very quickly, and I changed it from kind of comedy to action.
Right. Yeah. I know that Mark Wahlberg had success with, I think it was the Family Plan on Apple Plus. I like Mark, but oh man, that was a bad film, man. I don't know. Yeah. That was pretty bad. So I'm glad you wound up taking the direction that you did. You don't see too many spy novels that come out that have a comedic element, like an overt comedic element, do you?
Not really. And I think it's because, I mean, like I said, when I started this, it was, I had like kind of Kindergarten Cop or what's that other one? You know, the kind of comedy type things that are out there right now, you know, Spy Kids. And I had this kind of thing in mind, but because it is a very serious kind of game, as it were, you know, it does kind of, you need to be kind of gritty with it. And I think the comedic element, it's like all these films, they're very flashy in the pan, you know, they're on the cinema one minute, everybody goes and sees it, it's lovely, but then, you know, 2 years later, they're completely forgotten about, and everybody cringes when they look back at them.
Right, yeah, they all blend together almost, and I think if you're going to do a spy comedy, I think it works better on the screen than it does necessarily on the page, and I think there were a few exceptions with that, and the one that comes to mind about the whole genre in general, because I think he does everything well, Len Dayton. I mean, his hook, line, sinker, game, set, match books. I got to tell you that, yes, Berlin Game. I mean, A, he designed that cover himself from what I understand at first. And but B, I mean, the way he's able to tell a story that moves, is compelling, but also has so much humor in it, without ruining the story. I mean, some laugh out loud scenes throughout the first three books. that's tough to pull off. It's something Lucari didn't even try to do, but Dayton does, and plays very under the radar compared to greats like Lucari and Ludlum and all the attention they get. I would imagine that's pretty. You could find dark humor in your kind of stuff, but it's tough to pull it off, isn't it?
Oh yeah, and of course I've actually done that with my own. I've kind of kept the humor in there, but the humor is more in terms of banter between the kind of the protagonist and his two friends that are with him on this kind of journey. So
right.
Yeah, so it's not like there's no knock knock jokes in there. It's just kind of it's these guys having a laugh between them, because this is exactly how it is in the field. You know, sometimes you things go wrong and you've got to laugh. There's no other choice other than to just laugh and go, well, that didn't go as planned, you know, and right. kind of and then carry on and do what you've got to do.
Right. Yeah, and it's something else. It's because I think the more relatable the spies are, or the protagonists in spy fiction is, the better off, because you do want to avoid the cinematic Bond effect where the spy is completely unrelatable. He's like an ideal of what a guy would love to be able to do.
Yeah.
But, in terms of actual spycraft and believability, not necessarily, he probably wouldn't be the most successful spy, because everybody seems to know he's a spy.
Yeah, that's always the downside.
Right, but the books, if you read the books, they're pretty, they're much different. They take a bit of a darker turn. And I think that's what separates the two media, isn't it? From fiction, crime fiction and movies.
Yeah, in the movie world, everything's pretty polished. Everyone's, a kung fu expert who can always get the bullseye from 100 meters away. And in reality, things go wrong. And when they do go wrong, they go wrong with a domino effect. It's not just one little mess up and then you go, oh, okay, no worries, we'll get around it and do it this way instead. Something goes wrong, which then creates this whole kind of, ongoing problem that just and that's what I've tried to do in the book. I've tried to reflect that, that it's not just as everything's not simple and like kind of clean cut, as it were. There's a lot of times you'll get things wrong, your investigation will take you off one way and you'll think you've got something and it's a completely dead end, and then you think, what do you do now? And so and this is what I've tried to do. I've tried to keep that level of realism in there, without boring the reader too much, because you don't want to get them all excited thinking, oh, he's going to get the man or whatever, and then find out, that he's just got a bargain on an anorak at the market or something, so you have to kind of keep the, not make the wrong directions last too long.
Exactly right. Yeah, and it also has to accentuate the human element in it, because these people by and large do not look like George Clooney or Pierce Brosnan. They're successful because they're able to blend in, and because they're actually trying to do a job, just like a lot of us are trying to do whatever our job tends to be, but it has much higher stakes and much more danger in most cases. But it has its pitfalls. Well, as you just said, if one thing goes wrong, that cascades to a lot of other things. It is, and I think it sometimes the genre gets bogged down when they have too much hyper preparedness, where there's backups of backups and they swoop in to save it at the last minute. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, no, far from it. And of course, this polished kind of exterior of CIA agents and all these kind of guys who can just amazing at everything and good looking, impeccable suit. And it's far from it. I mean, in fact, so I remember when I was hired, and they turned around and said, "Oh, you're really lucky. We don't hire good looking people." Well, thanks. And I remember thinking to myself, well, cheers a lot then. That you could have used a bit of lubricant before you went for that. And they just went straight in for the kill. And I thought, oh, okay. And I realized afterwards they don't want people who turn heads, but at the same time, they don't want anybody who's that ugly that people are kind of looking at them because they're weird. And they don't want people that are super good looking. They want people in the middle, and they can make you one way or the other. I know this, they can, just with a change of attire and certain other elements, they can make you a lot more attractive if they need you to be. At the same time, and I can talk firsthand on this, I've been in a sleeping bag in doorways, smelling, unshaven, scruffy, and kind of, you know, on a rainy day, looking absolutely dreadful, because it is the perfect position to be in for everybody to come. The minute people think you're a homeless person, you become invisible.
Right.
So
people avoid looking at you.
Exactly. They won't look at you. They don't want to, you know, they will step over you and you won't be there. So I can sit in a doorway or in a porchway or somewhere all day long and perform surveillance for as long as I need to without anybody even noticing me. You know, the minute I've got somebody who's kind of that I'm following, I can then send the signal to the next person in the team to say, yep, they're on the move. And yeah, and that's me done, you know.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's funny too. People can mythologize, I would say, approach it from a mythological standpoint of what you guys do. But it's ultimately, you know, it's ultimately one person or a group of people trying to execute an objective. Mm-hmm. And that's you know, the way you do that can change or whatnot. But it's mm-hmm. it's often or not, it comes down to one person's weakness or one person's motivation mm-hmm. compared to yours. And that's at its heart, that's what a great spy story and a great thriller really is all about.
Oh yeah. And of course, when you've established your pattern of life for your asset and you've kind of got them on board, you've recruited them and you're getting secrets from them, it's absolutely fantastic. But the entire time you also have to be aware of the dangers that are around you. And I asked somebody to, somebody asked me once to sum up working as an intelligence officer in one sentence. And I said, it's the most dangerous way in the world to make friends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes. That's literally it.
Yeah, because it's about cultivating relationships no matter what you're doing, especially mm-hmm. if it's covert. Mm-hmm. You know, you're it's not just about having the fun thing about listening into conversations and planting mm-hmm. bugs and following somebody. It's if you cultivate the right relationship with an asset, you don't have to follow them because you know pretty much where they're going to go.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the following side and the surveillance side is usually generally done at the beginning, most of the time, not always. I mean, obviously, all situations are dynamic, but this is the bit where you're establishing patterns of life for them, you know, where they frequent the time, you know, where they go shopping, where they walk the dog, that kind of thing. And then from there, you can then build up that chance meeting that you're going to have. And I say chance meeting, you know, in hyphenated kind of speech. What are they called? Air quotes. That's the one.
Air quotes. I hate those, yeah.
People look like
a squirrel when they do that.
Yeah, so I don't like to do it.
Yeah, I don't either.
So, but yeah, the kind of chance meeting, it's chance for them. You know, for yourself, you've obviously set it up and spent a lot of time working out how it's going to go. And then that chance meeting ends up becoming a relationship, and that relationship then obviously gets cultivated. So, and if you've done it properly, you don't need to keep the surveillance going if you've got confidence in them to do a cleaning run to get to you and so on and so forth, and then usually from there you know you can cut it right down.
Right And it's often not, from what I've done with the research, because I've written a couple of techno thrillers myself about a spy agency, and it was fascinating the stuff that gives people away when they were looking for someone who might be a foreign operative. There was one guy, apparently the CIA agent was watching him. And he said that he was an American, he grew up, and he had never left the country, mm-hmm. but he was delivering flowers to his mistress, and he was carrying them with they were a bundle, and he was carrying them upside down. And the guy watching him said, this guy has spent time in Europe, or he's from Europe, because that's mm-hmm. what Europeans do. Americans don't do that.
Yeah.
And they hold them right side up. And sure enough, that wound up being they've dug into him deeper. And they mm-hmm. found it. So it's not always the bug on the phone or the hacked email that gives it away. It's a phrase, and he said more often than not, it's a phrase they use or something they avoid or something small they do that gives them completely away.
Yep. It can be something so simple. I mean, you know, a guy we know who was posing as a Russian a long time ago, and this is going back a long time, he was posing as a Russian in Russia, and he got found out just because he was whistling. And all of a sudden, everybody, all eyes went on him. And what it is in Russia, it's unlucky to whistle indoors. So, you know, you can whistle outdoors, no problem. But what it is, they've got this kind of superstition that if you whistle inside the house, it brings bad luck, bad financial luck upon that house. So, like, no money will come into that household. So it's the kind of, you know, yeah, it's a great big middle finger in a Russian house to do that in somebody else's house. Of course, that was how he was found out. And, yeah, it was a sad story how it all ended. But, but yeah, it was, yeah. And so sometimes these simple little things can be enough to kind of, you know, give you away in I think they made a film of it. I don't know if I can say the title on air, but I'm sure you've heard of it, where the guy, does Inglorious Bees.
Inglorious Bastards, yeah.
That's it. I didn't know whether I could say that on...
No, you can say whatever you want.
but yeah, that was recorded. And I think that the whole thing stemmed around the use of three fingers when he was ordering beers or something. I haven't actually seen the film, but I've been told about it. And that was where they kind of, where it all went wrong.
Right, yeah. It's interesting to be able to see, to know of those kinds of cultural traditions, if you will, and then include those in your writing. You know, I know, like in Brazil, for example, if you give the okay sign, it's a huge insult. And yeah. I did not know that until I was actually in Sao Paulo. And then thank God they could tell I was a gringo and they politely told me, don't do that again. I did it once. I didn't do it again. And I still this day have it 25 years later, 26 years later. But it's just interesting, though. Those are the kinds of details that you can pepper into your spy fiction. And when you're writing your spy fiction, do you try to balance the bang bang stuff with the spy craft, or would you say that your first book was more heavily influenced about the action?
There's a good amount of action in it because I mean, this was something that I didn't want to go too much down the route of, like, you know, having it too much of a cognitive overload. I wanted some action in there. I wanted the reader to enjoy it. And the truth of the matter is, I have been asked this before, if you're being chased through a foreign country at a high-speed chase with explosions and gunshots and all this, then you're doing your job very, very wrong. And you're probably not going to work in the industry again. Right. You know, so and the training's there for it. You know, it's something that, you know, in all circumstances, you're covered with, you know, escape and evasion, emergency exfils and all these things to, you know, for the eventuality. But it's a last resort.
Right.
You know, it's when you've tried everything else, because everything, if you've done your job properly, you've got in, you've got, you're under the radar, nobody's suspected you, nobody's detected you, you've done what you have to do, you've got the information you need, you've recruited an asset, sometimes you'll pass that asset on, it'll all depend on the situation, and then you'll get back out again and nobody will ever notice. And that's when you've done the job right. But with this book, I've done it in a, I've tried to keep a good amount of action in there, so there's constantly something going on, because he's gone on a unsanctioned kind of vendetta against the person who took his wife and daughter. So it's kind of not official, and that way he's got to cover his tracks. So there's a bit of all sorts going on, and like I said, I've crammed it with tradecraft.
Right. Yeah. And you can do that without being too heavy-handed in it, and you definitely do with this book, because you don't want to have, you want to have a good mixture of the first, let's say, John Wick movie, where you know, the action is fast and furious, but it's justified because you get to know him as a person first, then you have sympathy for him, and then you're really relieved. Oh God, he's a badass, awesome. The action's still unbelievable, but it you don't care because you're just glad that this guy is getting back a bit of his own. And I think that it's the best thriller books strike that balance. Like the early Tom Clancy books, for example, if you read Hunt for Red October, that was a great balance of spycraft and action. And because you also cared about the characters. But if you make it too much cartoon violence, like the later John Wick movie, especially the fourth one, it kind of, you tend to lose the people because you can't differentiate anymore between the story, and the action becomes almost cartoonish.
Yeah.
And in the later Clancy books, you get a lot of acronyms, a lot of technical stuff that becomes difficult to follow. And then there are people who love that stuff, but most readers, they want a nice little mixture of both. And I think you strike the right balance in your books.
Oh, well, thank you. And what I've done with it, very, very deliberately, because I didn't want to go down the traditional route. And this, in my opinion, it's very lazy for authors to put a partner or somebody who's completely, you know, like a civilian partner or an inexperienced partner.
Right.
And this is how they generally get away with trade, you know, explaining the tradecraft. Why are you doing that? Oh, I'll do it this way because of this. And I just thought, you know, it's so lazy just to stick somebody who knows nothing about it and explain the tradecraft that way. So what I did all throughout the book, I've got the main story, and then I'll have a little section which is in a box in italics, and it'll say tradecraft, and it'll say this is why we do it this way, this is how it's done, this is why we don't do it another way, blah 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 blah, and
right.
And you can choose to ignore them and just carry on reading the story. You can choose to read them if you don't know. You can choose to read them all if you want to just read it as a field manual. So it reads three different ways, depending on if you know nothing about the industry and you want to learn all the tradecraft, then it's all there for you. Or if you're experienced or you're seasoned or you're somebody who's read every single Clancy book and you know exactly why they do this or they do that, then you can just skip past that and carry on sticking to the story.
Right.
And that was, it's unique. It's very different. I don't think anybody's done it before. It'd be interesting to find out if somebody knows us, if anybody has ever tried it. But it's kind of, like I say, in my opinion, it gives a reader the chance to kind of get past the novice stage of having somebody in the background asking why and then having to explain it to the reader.
Right, right. Yeah, I approached it that way with my techno thrillers by having a very powerful computer system. But because I didn't want to have that stereotypical character at the time of the computer geek who is in intelligence but doesn't speak to anybody, maybe autistic and highly functional autistic, but has no social skills, but can crack any computer or whatever. And I just didn't want to have that voice in the ear. I wanted to have it, and it allowed me to meld in a lot of the other stuff about the spycraft I had researched into the story without it being a hard stop. And I think, mm-hmm. as you were just saying, you were hinting to earlier, I think we lose the audience when we have a hard stop.
Yeah.
For a pause for an information dump, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It kind of annoys me. And of course, I wrote this book for kind of two audiences. I wrote it for the kind of seasoned spy-fi reader who might enjoy this kind of thing and can skip past that, but at the same mm-hmm. time, I've written it for somebody who's new to the genre who doesn't necessarily know what VDMs are or what certain things are. So that and I've put a glossary in the front as well anyway to help them. But
right.
at the same time, they can read past all the bits and pieces or read into it. So hopefully it'll be a success. So far, I've had a good amount of feedback with the majority of people actually quite like it.
Right. Now, I know you've written nonfiction and you've also written fiction. What would you say has changed about your approach to novel writing from the first book as you're moving into your second book? Do you think you're going to change up some of the elements of what you learned in the first book into this second one, or how do you think this is going to flesh out?
I've learned so much even since writing the first book. So I remember when I first got into writing completely, it was actually my mother-in-law. She said you should write, and so I wrote out this first attempt at a book, and I sent it to her, and she called me up. She said, "This isn't a book; it's a report." Okay. She said, "Look, you've told me what's happened, but you've missed out crucial elements like the five senses. What are you smelling? What are you tasting? What are you hearing? She said, "You've got a total lack of description. She said, you're not explaining what you're feeling. She said, this happened and then that happened." So I've gone from that to kind of building a picture for the reader and kind of everything from character arcs and emotional events and just doing as much as I can and flooding the book with as much so that the reader can be in the book. And looking back now at number one, because I've actually written three parts. The first one's published, the second one's with the editor, and part three, which in my opinion is the best, I've just finished writing as well. They've increased in my opinion. They've got better, and the editor agrees with me as well. He said, "Look, number two's definitely a lot better than number one, and number three is just knocks them both out the water." So hopefully, I'm going to keep that going and just keep getting better.
Yeah. Well, that's it too. I mean, and that's the thing for people who have written a lot for a living, and you certainly have, not just with your nonfiction published work, but also with the reports that you've done and the kind of work that you did, which is something people don't focus on. You have to document damn near everything. And if you don't, you have to make sure somebody understands it. That's writing in and of itself. And you get to understand and learn the importance of facts. But then I found that people with your background, when they become novelists or even short story writers, they understand that they have to soften that a little bit, because you know the story that you want to tell and you've got it told in your mind. But relating it, as your mother-in-law said, is something different.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, this is something that you don't see on the movies, is the report writing. And that's the bit that's the worst. I hated, really, really hated that side of it. I wanted to be out doing stuff. I'm very hands-on. And of course, you know, it was something that so for those who don't know, when you've kind of had your meeting with the asset and they've left, and you're wherever you are, whether you're at a safe house, whether you're in a hotel, whatever the case may be, the moment that door is clicked shut and they've gone, you have to start writing the report straight away, then and there. And it's done very deliberately, so it's like there's no memory pollution, you don't forget anything, right. There's no distortion, there's, you know, is everything still fresh in your brain, and it's pen to paper, and you write down everything. You know, and literally every, you know, if the guy's got a new spot on his forehead, then you have to write that down, you know. And that was the bit that I hated, because sometimes it would take hours. And then I'd remember after writing it, you've then got to read it back to yourself, see if there's anything you missed. And then you realize there is. And then you've got to rewrite the whole thing to put that bit in. And, you know, so sometimes I've sat there and wrote the same report 6, 7, 8 times before it's finally ready to be handed in. And that's the bit that you don't see James Bond ever doing.
Right. You never do. No, you don't. And I can understand why you don't, but I think in the movies, but I think you're right. In a book, it humanizes the protagonist. And there's also some drama from a story style and device perspective. There's drama that can come out in that, because in the writing of that report, he can remember something that the reader saw, but it has significance. And you can introduce the fact through that retelling of it. You also don't want to rehash the entire scene, because that'll kill the momentum of a book too. Yeah. But remembering one of those details, that can make the detective story element of the thriller a lot more entertaining.
It is, because I love that part when you're reading a book and the detective writing the report and then gets that light bulb moment when something kind of goes, actually I wonder if this is connected to that, and then all of a sudden you're back to the action again. It can be quite useful.
It can be, yeah. I know that James Ellroy, in his American tabloid books and then all of his crime novels, he always accentuates the paperwork or the file room aspect of it, because he wanted to show that it's not just this cavalier style of going after the bad guy or the villain, but it's a very deliberative act to have an investigation. And that's fundamentally what's happening in your world. It's not as much of a cowboy situation as people tend to believe. It's far more deliberate, far more analytical than anybody thinks, and you can approach that without it being dry, and you strike a good balance with that in your book.
Thank you. And this is one of the other reasons why, because a lot of people don't realize that the majority of the time there's a lot of work. There's like 98% of what you're doing is boring. You're sitting down waiting for somebody to get into a car and follow them. You're waiting for somebody to leave a home or a property. And there's so much, especially when you're doing the surveillance side of things, that you're just sitting for hours, non-bum, you know, kind of going through the same old questions of why do I do this? And all the other things. And obviously the worse it gets. I mean, if it's a bad day and you're it's outside and it's raining and whatever, and you start questioning your life choices and, you know, and you look back on it, of course, and you go, oh, I miss those days. But the truth is, I don't. I wouldn't want to go back to it in reality. Great memories, but I wouldn't want to go back to doing it.
Of course.
You know, it's that 98% is so boring. It's paperwork. It's following. It's sitting. It's not doing much. But boy, that 2%, when you get to that 2%, that makes up for the 98% of boring, you know.
Yeah, it definitely makes it all worthwhile. And especially too, when you, if you are fortunate enough to be able to say, wow, I did stop something, or I did something bad from happening, or I did help something good to happen, or I helped someone who really needed it. that has to be a thrill unlike anything else.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And there is this kind of Hollywood trope that assets and agents are kind of, you know, pushed around, like, tell me this, tell me that, you know, and threatened and blackmailed and that kind of thing. And in reality, the majority of the time that is far from the truth, are actually very well looked after. This is when I said it's the most dangerous way in the world to make friends. When you've right. recruited that asset, you know, and I've got, like, people I recruited, I'm still friends with them now to this day. I get invites to go to family barbecues. I get all sorts of things that kind of, you know, that I, and of course they now know the situation and but yeah, this is something that, like I say, friends, they become friends for life the majority of the time. And it's great when you get them out of a bad situation to somewhere safe where they can, you know, kind of have their happily ever after, as it were.
Right, right. And I think the stories that are reflected, that are told based on the time that they're written, kind of reflect a lot of the mores of the time. For example, in the 50s, when they would portray Al Capone, he was always this snarling madman threatening to kill everybody. And that's because in America, there was a huge anti-crime push. So they had to make him the devil character. But as I've done research into that world and into Capone, a lot of people said he was an incredibly charming guy because he had to be, because he's the head of the mob family, the biggest mob in the country. But if he's a raving madman, people just aren't going to want to deal with him. And would have been scared of him and they wouldn't tell him the truth. He said, or they'd lie. And that's lethal to him. And he knew, I mean, yeah, he was still had people killed. He wasn't a good man. But in terms of characterization, there has to be a certain charm involved in working an asset, which is what a guy like Capone did with his mob underlings. And I would imagine it's the same there. If you come at somebody and you start screaming at them, yelling at them, or threatening them, you scare them, they clam up, and then they're no good to you.
Yeah. And of course, this whole kind of approach of, you see Hollywood, you know, where they'll put a gun to the head and say, you know, tell me X, Y, and Z, and then they'll tell them, and then they'll still carry on being friends with this agent. You know, it's complete and utter BS. Once you put a gun to somebody's head and said, you've got to tell me what I want to know, you'll never deal with that person again. They'll never have trust with you again. It's out the window. It's gone. And you're going to have to, the only thing you can do then is continue down that road. And each and every time you do it, it's going to be less and less threatening because of the fact that they go, oh, here we go again. You know, same old, same old. So that in itself is a complete fallacy. You know, it's more carrot than stick. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some instances where the compromise side of things does have to happen, but like I say, it's so rare, and it's you know, it's not the normal way things are executed, let me put it that way.
Right, I would imagine not. Yeah, because I mean, I would imagine it's more of a velvet boxing glove, if you will. You know, the threat is there, but if you use it too many times, it loses its effectiveness, as you just said.
Yeah,
it definitely does. So I know that you're working on two or three other books right now. I'm wondering, when do you think we might be able to expect some of those other works to come to market?
So part two of The Unforgiven Spy is going to be out probably for pre-order about mid-April, maybe towards the end of April at a push. So that should be out to pre-order for them, and hopefully getting released for the end of, not the end of summer, but you know, this summer. I'm waiting for one or two last little bits of editing, and I'm also waiting for one person from an intelligence agency to get back to me, because I'm gonna put something in there that's gonna be a bit of a revelation. And I need to know that I'm not going to get executed for putting it in there.
Yeah, we laugh, but when the guys in the windbreakers show up at your house at 2 a.m, it's not funny. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. So, but yeah, we you know, hopefully with a bit of luck. So I've got a little bit of a hard and fast rule with the tradecraft that I put in the books. As I've said, I've put tons of it in there in book one. There's even more in book two. And I am revealing stuff that isn't normally talked about. It's the tradecraft that get taught to intelligence officers that it doesn't normally make the shelves or the movies. But my rule is, as long as it's not going to put anybody in danger, that's right. that's my kind of, you know, hard and fast rule with it. So I think the one thing that I have refused to put in from the very beginning is to teach people how to make explosives. There's right. tons of other stuff in there, but there's no good reason that I can think of that anybody would want to make a bomb. So, right. You know, right. so that, and there is a slight exception to that. And there is a caveat with this as well, by the way. The slight exception is in part three, I've put on how to make an improvised hydrogen bomb in there. However, I haven't quite given all the details. It's a bit like if somebody says, how do you bake a cake? And you say, oh, you get a bit of egg, a bit of flour and a bit of sugar. And you mix it all up and put it in the oven for a while.
Right.
That's not exactly how you make a cake. You know, you need oven right. temperatures, you need quantities, you need times. And so very much similar with the improvised hydrogen bomb that I've put in there. I thought, again, there's no reason why anybody would need the specific instructions for this. So
exactly,
I just
yes.
kind of outlined what you'd need.
Right. Yeah. And it's not like someone can pop down to the Home Depot, get some hydrogen and do this anyway, but you're right. Yeah. You don't want to get, and you know, with if it's something is Googleable, you know, they could find it on their own. But yeah, there are limits to fiction, especially you have to be responsible about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you definitely have been.
Oh yeah, I mean for sure, and I mean I know of a case where I mean we were taught to make explosives just from aspirin and you know kind of different medications and that kind of thing. But the problem is it's so unstable. There was an instance once where one guy did it and he got one grain caught between. He was making it. The whole thing was going into like a bottle. And what he'd done is he'd put the made-up ingredients in the bottle, and one grain of this very unstable powder got caught between the thread of the bottle and the cap. And when he twisted the cap to tighten it up, it snapped, and he blew his fingers off. So that's the kind of thing that it's all well and good knowing how to do it. The majority of the stuff that I know how to do, I would probably look at and go, I'm not sure that even this situation, I'm not gonna risk a few fingers just to see if I can get home.
You got to put that scene in one of the books, though. That is priceless. I love that. I absolutely love that. Wow, you definitely have to use that.
Oh, yeah, that might go in there one day. I might put it in one of the... I might do a specific book called The Spy Outtakes.
Yeah, Spy Bloopers, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So, I mean, you've got a lot going on. You've got a lot coming up. What's the best way that the audience can follow you on social media, websites, stuff like that?
Well, the one I'm trying to build at the minute is my YouTube channel, and I get all kind of guys from the intelligence community to come over. Some of them are friends I've worked with before. You know, there's a mixture of people that I've worked with and for and whatever else. So I've recently had on David Bickford, who's the former legal director of MI5 and MI6. He come on and did an interview with me. I've had spy recruiters from the FBI. I've had Jack Barsky from the KGB. I've had guys from CIA, so all the three-letter agencies, basically the whole alphabet soup is in there. So if you just look Gavin Stone Author on YouTube, and that's my kind of main go-to that I'm trying to build at the moment. And then I've got the usual social medias, Twitter, Facebook. So Twitter's at Author Gavin. Facebook is Gavin Stone Author. And what's the other one everybody's using at the moment? Instagram. Yeah, I don't really use that much. I put the odd thing on here or there, but yeah, I am on there as well as Gavin Stone One.
Awesome. Well, thank you for taking the time to do this, my friend. This is a really great conversation, and I really appreciate it. And I think the audience does too.
I really hope so. Thank you for having me on. I hope they enjoyed.
Oh, I'm sure they did. And thank you, everyone, for joining us for yet another edition of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes right here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. We'll see you next time, everyone. Take care.
You have been listening to Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes with host Terrence McCauley on Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.